Let me take a minute to tell you about a great website because I've been using it when I'm stuck in with the snow and everything else. I decided to use deepdiscount.com. They have thousands of movies and TV shows, great prices. You click their logo on my homepage. It's right there. And you'll see what I mean. Be sure to look for special icons and coupon codes for even more savings. Look, don't waste time searching and searching to find your favorites. And they just, you know what they do? They put it in the new release row on the on-demand, and then they put it in the popular, and it's a repeat. I wasn't born yesterday. Look, there's no more commercials, no more edits or bad streams that buffer all the time, and that's if you can find something good. Go to deepdiscount.com and buy the shows you want to watch and own them forever. You'll find classics from back in the day. I just bought Slapshot, great movie right up there with Caddyshack and Animal House. You find hard-to-find titles and new releases. Out this week, The Commuter, starring Liam Neeson as a guy on a train who's not having a good day. He just got fired and now, on his commute home, gets pulled into a conspiracy happening on the train. Still sounds better than most of my commutes. Get your copy now on DVD and Ultra HD for a great price at deepdiscount.com. Just click their logo on my homepage. It's right there. You can't miss it. Be good to yourself. Buy your favorites and support my sponsor, too. It always helps, and that helps me keep putting out great podcasts and great guests. So I really appreciate it if you can go on there, click, check it out, and buy a little something. Check it out now. Thank you, Deep Discount. Hey, everybody. On this episode of the podcast, I have Emmy and Peabody Award-winning comedian, comedic actor, Stephen Colbert. From The Daily Show, The Colbert Report, now The Late Show with Stephen Colbert. Stephen and I are friends, go back to The Daily Show together, working on that show together. And a really cool conversation with Stephen about the Colbert Report character, how that came about, his childhood, the tragedy that happened in his childhood that sort of had a big part in being who he is today. Just a really cool conversation, funny, really enlightening, and just really, really interesting. I really love talking to him, and I think you're going to enjoy it. Thanks for checking out the podcast. Spread the word. Send the links around to your friends, family, your milkman, and follow me on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, at Paul Mercurio. Thanks, folks.
I'm here with my very good friend, longtime friend.
Longtime friend.
We're shaking hands.
Yeah.
Stephen Colbert, thank you for doing this. You're super busy, and I appreciate it. And we go way back to the Daily Show days of yesteryear, 1999 to, what, 2005 or something like that?
Yeah, absolutely. And, like, one of my most fun things I ever wrote was with you.
Ah.
We wrote it. It was on the night that Al Gore finally conceded in December of 2000.
Right.
When it was official that Bush was going to be president.
Right.
We had a piece on that night about...
Right.
It was about predicting the future. Remember? It was like what the Bush presidency would
right.
be. You and I wrote that together.
Right.
That was fun.
It started, you know... And writing with Stephen, it's like you sort of jump on the train and just kind of keep up because he's such a great improviser, not just in actual improvisation, but in terms of writing. And so we would just start feeding each other lines and just...
Great.
And it
was a lot of fun.
And he'll arrive on a chariot and it was...
Exactly. He will make whores of our wives and slaves of our children. He will appoint a horse to the Senate. And, you know, with his aged squire, Dick Cheney holding the laurel wreath or his furrowed brow... The man who would be boy king, like
read
that whole
yeah.
thing, like that.
Like,
his you know his body rubbed with unguents and perfumes rendered from the bones of the persecuted poor. You know, like it was a pretty good prediction of the next 8 years,
accurate.
I think.
And I think you mentioned that episode that it was in ended up getting submitted for the Emmys.
I think that was what got submitted that year.
Yeah. It was great.
Well, we kind of had blue balls on that episode. The show had blue balls on that episode. I can't speak for John, but because we'd written things for the denouement when we would know what happened,
right.
But we couldn't use any of them. So
right.
that show was just like a,
pah! Yeah,
we all felt
exactly.
Like,
it was probably
just
like
packed. Like we were just like packing a musket with how many jokes we could get into one show.
It was our
greatest story of all time.
Yeah,
because it mattered to everyone,
right.
And no one died.
Yes.
You know, at least not for a couple more years.
And it was actually a story that was a perfect story for The Daily Show to sort of move to that next level, because we were the only show really set up with correspondence, with green scenes, that could go, okay, I remember Carell doing a bit where he's in front of the Supreme Court, and like the bit was something like he just didn't even know what's this, where the states were.
Panicking.
Like, panicking, yeah. And he's crying. He does that great Carell, like,
right.
And he starts crying. It just was...
That was fun. I remember that show, with the after doing that thing that you and I wrote, I turned to John as I was going to the commercial break, and I said, I think this is the best job on television. Like, I can't imagine what could be more fun than that moment.
Well, you came to that job, it was kind of tricky. Like, what's fun to talk about is sometimes people don't realize how hard it is to get where you get in this business, right?
Like, it takes a long time.
And people,
a lot of
say
people,
no.
Overnight successes after 20 years.
Right.
That's the cliche.
Right. And you know, we'll get into this in a minute, but you come from a great improv background.
I was on the show. I got hired when it was still Craig Kilborn.
Right.
And then when Craig left, Brian Unger and A. Whitney Brown also left at the same time. And they were looking for people, and I think they'd already hired Mo and Mo Rocca.
Yeah.
And I don't think Vance yet, but... And they said, do you know anybody? And I kept on saying, Steve Carell. He looks straight, but he can make anything funny.
Yeah.
He can make anything funny. And they're like, nah, what's he done? And I'm like, well, he was on Carvey. Like, he would have been on the Carvey show with me. And they're like, eh. And I went on for like 6 months. And they were still like, we're desperate. You have to know somebody. And I said, Steve Carell. And then I finally remembered what they would know him from. I went, waiters who are nauseated by food, which was a scene we did on the Carvey show, which had no jokes. It was all behavior.
Right.
And
it was just that.
We were waiters who were nauseated by the concept of food. And we're reading a specials list. That's it. And we just are going, say we have a Cobb salad with a... with a warm bacon cream dressing. And it was based on how I used to go, because I waited tables for 5 years and I'd be hungover having to read specials lists to people.
That's hilarious.
And I was like, oh, someday I want to turn this into something.
Yeah.
And Carell had a very similar scene called, it wasn't called, neither one was called it, but he had a very similar game that he actually did at Second City for a few sets called, which we called Podiatrists Who Are Nauseated by Feet. And we both wrote our own things. Like, well, you write yours, I'll write mine. We both submitted them to Schmeigel and Carvey.
Yeah.
For the Carvey show, and Robert goes, we'll do them both. We'll do waiters who are nauseated by food first, because it makes a little more sense.
Right.
Than podiatrists, and then we'll do a series. You guys will just do a series of these things.
Oh, that's great.
And then we got canceled before we could ever do podiatrists who are nauseated by feet.
That show was so edgy and ahead of its time.
Yeah,
and
it was
like,
a weird show. So it was really enjoyable to work. I really had a good time, but it was weird. Like, you look back and it goes, yeah, that was a little edgy, especially considering we were following Home Improvement.
Like, I forget about that.
At the time, Home Improvement and Seinfeld were trading off the number one slots.
Oh, they were? Okay.
Yeah, because Seinfeld ended in 98, so it was high Seinfeld, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
And Home Improvement was sometimes bigger, you know, on a given week. But it was so kind.
Yeah.
Like, Home Improvement was so gentle.
Yeah, I know.
In many ways.
I know.
And then it would, this unbelievable gear shift from, you know, the next door neighbor implying, you know, supplying a form of comical wisdom.
Right.
And Tim, the character that
Tim Allen
would take to heart.
Right.
And then it would shift gears, and it would be Dana dressed up as Bill Clinton with multiple teats like Diana of Ephesus feeding puppies and kittens.
And you were working with some really quality people. Louis C.K., Robert Smigel,
Louis
Dino.
Louis C.K., Robert Smigel. Louis was head writer. Robert was executive producer, along with Dana. Dino Stamatopoulos, Mike Stoyanov, Scott Atsit. That was a different project. Mike Stoyanov, Charlie Kaufman, Robert Carlock.
Unbelievable.
Carell, Steve O'Donnell, Dave Cross.
I forgot
Bob Odenkirk, Spike Ferriston. I mean, it's an unbelievable.
Why doesn't ABC move that to another time slot? Put it on late night?
Because it wasn't what they wanted. I think was who was the head? Bob Iger. It was an ABC thing, and ABC was recently got purchased by Disney, and I think they wanted like a variety show feeling. I think they wanted a kind of a Carol Burnett show, which I no one is a larger fan of Carol Burnett than I am, but that's not what I went on. I didn't go on to write or create that.
Yeah.
And they wanted something like that. They really wanted a variety show. He thought he could bring it back.
So that, for you, comes off of Exit 57, Strangers with Candy.
I hadn't done Strangers yet. But
Strangers,
done,
right, was while you were at
done
the Daily Show.
And then,
so was there, like, a big learning curve? Did it raise your game from Exit 57 to that, and that experience on Dana Carvey, even though it was 7 episodes, I think, that aired, something like that?
Yeah, we made 8-7 aired.
That sort of informed your work going forward?
Sure. I would say if you look back at the stuff we did at Vegas 57, some of which is, you know, funny. You know, some, but only some, I think.
No, come on.
No, honest to God. I was done with a lot of love. Like, we threw ourselves at it. And we certainly, in terms of, there are two things I learned. One is about getting to the joke.
Yeah.
You know, cooking faster.
Yeah.
As Rodney Dangerfield said, how fast can you cook?
Right.
And I learned to cook a lot faster writing for Smigel and Dana.
Because you get that feedback from them and go
back
and cut it.
Because we had no real feedback on X57. We were just children trying to teach ourselves how to read.
Right.
You know,
and
like,
the network, Comedy Central, was at that time the kind of network that would allow you to do that. You know.
Yeah, well, also because it was an orphan network, because it was owned by both Time Warner and Viacom, and no one wanted responsibility. Right. It was like the redheaded stepchild. Nobody really wanted this kid.
Right.
And so it was very little feedback. I mean, there was certainly nobody. Joe Forrestal, who was our exec on that show, was a very nice guy, but he wasn't. I mean, he trusted us, and he wasn't like grinding out scripts with us. Whereas Smigel was, you know, this is the discipline I need you to bring to a script. He taught me enormously, and I was very grateful that he believed in me, because I think you know, people looked at my work and they went, well, he's good at kind of like a utility guy. He could help somebody else's jokes.
Oh,
but
really?
Smigel went, no, he's funny too.
Yeah,
and he think he asked them to trust. He asked Dana and Louie and the people to trust that I would be funny. And I'm very grateful. I'll always be grateful for Robert for the faith he had in me.
Well, you know, in high school...
Well, the other thing I was going to say is, besides the fact he taught me to cook faster, like, you've got to get to the joke faster. Like, we did the scene with Isaac Hayes, which is not important what the scene was about, but he goes, you've got to get to Isaac Hayes faster, and you've got to say, it's Isaac Hayes. And I'm like, oh, of course. And it seems very simple.
Yeah.
But he looked at me one day in editing and he goes, why are you hiding your joke from the audience? Why are you hiding it from them? And I went, oh yeah, there's no need. Don't worry about feeding them your punchline a little bit stronger.
Yeah.
And he taught me that. And the other thing was I learned is there are ways to do the show and not kill yourself. X-37, I almost never went home. We'd sleep in the offices.
Mm.
You know, it was terrible.
Well, what was it about that you were able to streamline your process for Carvey? Did you have bigger staff, more money?
I wasn't responsible. Like, X-37, we were responsible for our stuff.
Right.
You would produce your pieces for Carvey, like the SNL model.
Oh.
But, where the writer was the producer.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, Dana and Louie and Robert were the ones who all this was all on their shoulders.
So they're standing.
And all on Dana's shoulders as a performer. We were supporting him.
Right.
We were there gratefully, you know. Right. We were very proud. And I remember how happy we were. We saw Dana go on Letterman, you know, early on, right before we launched. And all of us going, that's our boss.
Right,
you know?
Right.
Like, we loved
and
it.
And you're living through that.
We loved it.
There was that for me, when I was on Wall Street doing M&A deals as a lawyer and a banker and stuff, and I sold some jokes to Jay Leno, because I got to see him at a private function, and I was writing jokes as a hobby, and I didn't know what to do. So I went up to him very sheepishly after this private function, and I go, I have these jokes, and he takes them or whatever, and he goes, hey, come back here, you might want to put your name and your phone number on here so I know how to reach you, right? This is how nervous I was. And he calls me 2 days later, and he goes, I read your stuff. He goes, would you want to write for The Tonight Show? I'm like, okay, how does that work? He goes, well, don't leave your job. You just send me stuff, and if I use it, I pay you. And a week later, he called me, said, I'm going to do one of your jokes tonight. And he did my joke. I got my wife, Carol.
What was it?
It was about this old house and these refurb shows that they don't reflect reality. You know, that the contractor's like on time, under budget, you know, clean shaven in reality, you know, they're hitting on your wife, drunk, going through your drawer for money, you know, over, you know, one of those kind of things. And for him it was perfect because it's broad and for that, you know, for that demographic work. And I saw him do that joke and it was the same feeling you just described with Dana. So living through that, it was like, oh my God, now
for a middle-class kid from Rhode Island to be doing huge M&A deals that were literally on the cover of the front page of the Wall Street Journal, this $50 joke had way more power and blew my head off my shoulders. And then I became obsessed with this.
Sure, sure.
So I know that feeling. But the idea of getting to the joke quicker, I would think, with, for people who don't know, I'm sure a lot of people do know, but that you have a improv background. I mean, in high school, you were sort of playing in theater and writing on the newspaper, and you were...
Didn't write the newspaper. Didn't do theater until my senior year.
In
high
school.
Wanted to. Wanted to perform, but just didn't.
Yeah.
Thought I would, even as a kid, I think I'd like to be a comedian. Didn't know what that meant.
Yeah.
Didn't, there was no outlet for there.
Yeah, like, I used to watch comedians on The Tonight Show and go, oh, that's cool, but I never thought I'd be a comedian, right?
I guess I didn't think I'd be a comedian. I mean, that was, my mom would let me, if there was a comic on The Tonight Show, she'd let me stay up and watch.
Right.
Whoever it was, right. David Steinberg or David Brenner, all the Davids.
Yeah, yeah.
And, I love David Brenner. My mom and I love David Brenner. And, but I guess I didn't think it'd be stand-up, and I never had my ambition was never be a stand-up, and I admire people who can do it, but I like, that's not my world.
Right.
I wanted to be an actor, but I always thought I wanted
comedic
to be
actor.
A comedic actor. Right. I always thought I'd be a comedic actor until I started doing it. Then I thought I'd be a dramatic actor because I don't know why.
Well, you
I was depressed. I was really depressed, and I thought I'll be Hamlet, as I've said before. I'll be Hamlet, not act Hamlet, and that sucks, man. I just was not into that at all. I did
well,
that
was
for
this
years.
Hampton Sydney College? You were at the Hampton Sydney College for 2 years.
I was
years,
at Humpty Dumpty in Virginia, Old Sid, for 2 years, and I didn't know I performed there, but that was I studied mostly philosophy there,
right.
And that was real a lot of.
So where did it click in for you that you wanted to act?
Oh, well, I realized that the only thing I was actually doing, I did a couple of shows at Hampton Sydney, and I thought, wow, that's the only thing. As I worked hard on my classes and, you know, my liberal arts education, but I realized I will show up to rehearsal at any time, day or night, and I'll stay as long as it takes to get it right.
This was something that you were motivated to
and
do.
And I thought, wow, I'd be really dumb not to pay attention to how hard I'm willing to work on that more than anything else. Like, I'm eager for how hard the work is.
So you were a little meandering or lost at that time? Well, not that anybody's focused at that age.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I barely got into college anyplace. I was like a complete...
You?
Oh, I was a complete fuck-up in high school. Yeah, barely graduated. If I hadn't pulled A's in my finals my senior year, I would never.
Were you doing just hanging out, fucking around with your friends, doing?
Yeah,
all
yeah,
stuff
yeah,
that
yeah.
Did.
I mean, I stopped like when I was, as you know, you may know, my dad and two of my brothers died when I was young, and after they died, I just didn't do any homework.
Yeah,
you know, I was like a quote unquote smart kid who tested well and all that kind of stuff, but there was no rationale I could see to play the game. And it all seemed crazy to me. Like, what? What paper? Do what? You're going to do what? Oh, no. Don't tell me you're going to give me a bad grade. That would be terrible. Like, there was no weapon. There was no weapon. There was nothing to hold over me. And my mom was, God bless her, my mom was not entirely there.
Yeah.
You know? God, not entirely there. She wasn't looking at me to crack a whip over me. She was like, you're alive, you're fine.
Yeah, you're just, trying to get through the day.
Exactly. Right. You're alive, you're fine.
Yeah, it's true.
And the benefit of that is that I read anything I wanted. And I read tons of stuff. And I like to say I graduated incidentally. Because I would learn so much because I read like a book a day that I would kind of learn what was in the books they were wanting me to read anyway, because there's just so much crossover between writing.
I never thought of this, but let me ask it. I mean, if that tragedy hadn't happened, do you think you'd be doing what you're doing today? Do you think you would have sort of like become traditional?
I'd be a totally different person. I don't know what I don't know. I don't know whether I would have been a comedian. I don't know whether. I mean, I might have been a performer. I don't know. I mean, part of wanting to perform is not just. I think necessarily a reaction to the events of my life, but one of the biggest events of my life is my mother. My mother wanted to be a performer.
Oh, is that right?
I'm the last child, and I would have been deeply exposed to my mother's worldview or dreams just by being the last child, let alone the only child.
Yeah,
you know, with dad
true.
And the boys gone.
What kind of performer was? What was her passion?
Oh, she wanted to do theater. You
really?
Know, she taught us to do pratfalls as a kid, and she studied at the New School, and she was going to go to the CIT, well, Carnegie, the Institute of Technology.
Yeah.
It was Carnegie Mellon, it was CIT, Carnegie Institute of Technology, which the joke was the theater school was so hard there that it was called Christ, I'm Tired. And she was accepted, and then she got, this sounds stereotypical or sounds like a cliche, but she got a rare tropical disease. She went on a trip with her mother to Haiti.
And she came back and some parasite or something. And she was bedridden for about 6 months. And to the point where the doctor was sure she was going to die. And so that was the year she was supposed to go off to CIT. And then as soon as she recovered, my dad said, "Will you marry me?" And that was it. And then she never, she didn't graduate from college. She actually didn't go
and that generation didn't go, "Hey, let me put off marriage or kids and pursue a career." It's like, boom.
She got married, had 11 kids. And then when I was off in the world, I was off at Second City. It was in the 80s. I think she, 1985. No, not 85, 185. 89 or something like that. So she was 68 or 69 when she graduated from college. So anyway, that was it. So, I mean, I'd be a totally different person if that happened. I don't know. Certainly that informs everything I do in some level because it informs my worldview so much. But, you know.
I mean, you're devoutly religious now in some way. Well, I mean, it's a big part of your life, or a part of your life.
It's a part of my life.
Did that happen?
Comparably speaking to a lot of the people I know in comedy, I'm devoutly religious, but that doesn't mean a lot.
You know what I mean?
Because it's an iconoclastic employment. Like what you do, it's got iconoclastic, and, you know, Catholic Church is full of icons.
Is there anything that you don't or haven't done or wouldn't do, whether it was with...
Yeah, I don't make jokes about the Eucharist, you know, generally speaking.
Because
I have done them, but, you know, I don't want to make jokes about the sacrament for the sacrament's sake. I also, that's a line for me. I wouldn't make a joke about Christ on the cross.
You know,
somebody could probably find me breaking this rule I just said to you, but certainly
I happen to have it here.
I know, you know, but I mean, like, I don't know because you do so many jokes. And the pressure of the moment might do something to you, but I would say I wouldn't want to do jokes about the sacrament. I wouldn't want to do jokes about the passion itself. But I also try, and I'm not very good at it, I try not to make jokes about someone's religion for what the religion is, but for the abuse of that religion.
Yes. You know,
the use of it.
Yes.
Because I'm interested in a lot of people's religion. I mean, for all I know, Muhammad rode to heaven on a horse. You know?
Right.
For all I know, they're right. You know what I mean?
Who are we to judge?
Judge not, lest you be judged.
But are there things that are...
I'll make fun of the church 6 ways
to
Sunday.
You have no... But you're not so wedded to the Bible that you... I mean, you'll question the Bible and you'll challenge the Bible.
What part of it are you talking about, Paul?
All of it? No. Right? I mean, you're not...
I propose to you. I posit that Noah's Ark is a metaphor.
How about that? Tell Steve Carell that. No. Eben Almighty. But, yes. So the answer is yes, right? I mean, you know, and that's not having a sacrilegious stance toward your views. It's sort of just putting on a different hat when you're reading the good book, right?
Yeah, no, no. I mean, I think you got to make up your own mind when you're reading scripture.
Yeah,
I mean, you got to make up your own mind when you're doing everything. You've only got your mind to think with. So I mean, I happen to, you know, be profoundly affected by the story of Jesus, and I can know more, as Robert Bolt says in his introduction to A Man for All Seasons, I can no more remove that from me than you can the marble from the shape of a statue. That is just who I am.
Right. Yeah. Well, and you're true to it, which is great. I mean, I want to ask you about, like, Amy Sedaris.
That's nice of you to say I'm true to it. I don't know if I agree with you.
No, you are. Because you're a very fundamentally decent person, which is what was... By the way, let's talk about Daft Punk for a minute, which was so fun about that whole episode, because that just happened a day or two ago, and a few days ago. When this is going to air. And we'll give people
a synopsis.
I saw the fruit of it.
It's been happening for over a month.
Right, yeah. So if you don't mind, just give us a little background, and we'll catch people up who haven't seen it, but pretty much most people have. But go ahead.
Most people have not seen Daft Punk on my show. Come on my show. I don't know, 6 weeks ago now, something like that. I was approached by my booking producers saying, would you be interested in Daft Punk? Because we do music on the show sometimes, and we do more music in the summer. Sometimes we do a summer concert series.
Right.
And
did one on the Intrepid last
summer. A couple years ago. We did Radiohead.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, we did a week of Jack White. Anyway, so they said, would you be interested at all in Daft Punk? I'm like, yeah, they don't really do like TV and that kind of stuff. They said, no, it'd be kind of a big deal. They'd say they're fans and they'd like to come on. And I said, no, that'd be great. That'd be great. Well, I think we approached them, but they said, yeah, they like the show. They'd like to come on. I said, oh, cool. Yeah, they don't do their shows on, and they don't even talk, right? That'll be fun. So about a week goes by, and I said, look, well, they don't want to be interviewed. They don't want to be interviewed because they don't talk. And I said, oh, well, that's get-aroundable. That's get-aroundable, you know? That I could do a six-minute monologue in the form of a super, like, Pitchfork Media or, you know, old Rolling Stone, like, is random access memory, you know, meant to be a double entendre on both the computer-generated nature of the music, but also you are randomly accessing all the artists who, from your youth in, say, the L.A. late 70s, early 80s disco scene, emulated a certain sound that suffered from the post-punk disco rejectionist attitude, and then you've reassembled them into a random access to create new memories that at one and the same time touch us deeply in our own core processing musical unit. Like could I do a 6-minute monologue of that and then just have them nodding the entire time?
That's
where I thought I'll do something like that. Yeah. We actually started on that.
Yeah.
And then I said, yeah, I could do that. And then they do their song in the second act. And then another week goes by and goes, yeah, they're not going to do their song.
Oh, come on.
And I said, well, I'm beginning to see why they don't do TV. Because
it's an audio medium as well as a visual medium.
Exactly. I said, well, I think we're dropping some coin on these guys, right? We're flying these cats in from Paris and not in coach. to do the show.
Yeah.
Like, they're not in New York. We're bringing them in.
Yeah.
And they're like, do you want to cancel? I'm like, no. I mean, this is an interesting challenge.
This is,
and I'm also kind of intrigued by the fact that they have these characters.
Right. And by the way, let's not skip over that, because when you're producing a show day in and day out, there is a sort of a rhythm and a routine to it, like any job, including driving a bus. So I think that's a big point that Steven's making, is like, you do like the challenge of something
different
is going to happen.
A change is as good as a holiday.
Your ears perk up, your eyes get a little wider. Right?
Oh, I have to figure out a way to do that and not do X, Y, and Z.
Right.
All right, that's fun. Let's see if we can figure that out.
Right.
So I said, and I think when I was told that they, you know, they would be there but not do anything, or rather whatever we did would have to be within the confines of them not doing their music and not also talking.
Mm-hmm.
Though, you know, there was some conversation about how could we end up communicating, which they were not opposed to. And I looked up at my board, and I saw that Jeff Bridges was a guest either that night or the next night. And I went, oh, you know what we could do is... And I pictured him dancing on the Lebowski steps.
Oh, right.
From Big Lebowski.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, we could do... I could say, maybe they haven't heard their song lately. I mean, it's really good, because we wrote a part for their manager, who's a nice guy named Paul Hahn. And he would come and goes like, no, they don't do... You know, they don't talk, and they don't do their song. and you know, like, you know... They're very excited to be here. I'm like, oh no, I can tell. I can tell they're excited. You know,
they're making eye contact.
Yeah, exactly.
It's huge.
Exactly. You know, we had one joke. I wish we could have done this joke. And this joke was, Paul, can I ask you, how do I even know it's them in the robot outfits? How do I even know it's them? And he goes, Steven, if it wasn't really them, they'd be doing the song.
That's great.
I really wanted to do that joke. You know, I really wanted to do that fucking joke. So there we are, and I'm like, okay, I'll do a video where I'm trying to convince them to do their song, because it's so irresistible. Like, it's a brain worm. You cannot get that thing out of your head.
Right.
And I said, and that'll be it. And I said, let's see who we could get to play with me. So we started talking about that. And then about a week goes by, we shoot Jeff Bridges that night. Because I ask him if he'll do it, and he goes, oh yeah, I know those guys. They did the soundtrack to Tron.
Oh. And he goes, far out, I'll do that.
Cool.
Honest to God. I'm like, okay, great. So,
and he said far that's out why, to
as he did. He said, far out, man. I think he said, yeah, man, far out. Like, I'll do that. Because I really like him. He's such a relaxing presence to be with. So you might notice, like, if you watch the little video of what we did, he's like the least poor, like, he's so poorly lit, like, in the piece.
Yeah.
It's hard to tell these Jeff Bridges and everything. Because
that was here at the studio.
Because it was right after the show. I said, because he had to go. And I said, just stand on the stairs and we'll shoot up and we'll just try something. Yeah. So that's what you saw. It's just
right,
us
kind of just
playing.
Right.
He was cool about it. And then at the same time we found out, well, Robin Thicke is available too. Would you like to have Robin Thicke on? And somebody said, hey, you know, he kind of solves the problem, because you want to do the Song of the Summer, and like people are saying that might be the Song of the Summer, maybe you could do that. And I said, yeah, it only solves half the problem, because I actually want to figure out how to have Daft Punk on and not have Daft Punk on. Like, how do I not have not perform and yet we still get the joy? Could we make something so joyful that it felt special enough to justify calling it a Daft Punk night?
Right.
And I said, I think we're on our way to doing something like that.
Right.
And I said, but Robin Thicke satisfies the Hyundai, the sponsor, because we have an intrusive sponsor called Hyundai. We always have intrusive sponsors for their concerts. And I said, he satisfies them in an interesting way. And I said, let's do both. And so he was only available a certain day, and so I said, let's have him do that, and that'll be a surprise for the audience. And then Robin Thicke couldn't do the show.
Oh, Jesus.
Because the VMAs also had Robin Thicke. The Video Music Awards at MTV had Robin Thicke was going to be on there, and he couldn't do both. And I called the people at my network, and I said, "Can you help us out? That they're MTV, we're MTV." And
right.
They called Van Toffler, and Van said, "Yeah, we'll work."
He's the president of MTV Networks.
Van Toffler is the head of the MTV networks, and they worked it out.
MTV, not MTV, is
MTV Networks and Logo Group. Right. I think that's what it's called. And they worked it out so that Robin Thicke could come on and do it, and I'm very grateful for that.
Yeah,
and that was cool.
Right.
And so we shot that, and that was fun. And then Daft Punk says, we've looked at the script that you've done for us, and the guys, the robots, aren't happy with it.
Or, oh, Jesus.
Well, not happy is not the right. They're uncomfortable with it. Like, because it's playing too much on the idea that they're not performing as opposed to the joy of them being there. And we had a, you know, back and forths about that, you know.
Yeah.
So they're not sure if they want to do it now. And I said, well, we have to talk about it, or else you probably shouldn't come. I don't know what to do. You know, you probably shouldn't come. But then they talked to, their manager talked to, I think, the guys, Emmanuel and Tomas.
Mm-hmm.
And once I heard what they had to say, I understood. They were happy to have us talk about the fact that they don't do these things on air, but they wanted to be done in some sort of active way. They didn't want to be passive. They didn't like the robots doing nothing. They wanted the robots to be doing some fun stuff. So, and they had some good ideas,
right.
You know, and the Daft Punk guys actually had some funny ideas on how to do it. So we incorporated their ideas. I mean, we're working like all weekend. You know, I'm on the phone like 5 hours on Sunday. You know, we were getting the script around. And so we've got it. We've figured it out. We say, come on, get on that plane. Come, you know, from Paris to get over here. I'm feeling good. I'm actually, this is a really, by the end of the day, it's like, you know what? This has actually been a very positive process. And when it was, you know, frustrating for a little bit, how many times I had to go back
and forth. Right, but again, it goes back to this challenge of something. And you've got your components lined up. You've got Thicke. You've got this video that your compilation you put together.
I mean, this might be a longer answer than you want.
No, I want this because, honestly, I've been going around the last couple of nights. People know I'm affiliated with the show and do the warm-up, and they're like, did that really happen? Like, people want to know. Please, because people want to know. Yeah. Trust me.
So, it ended up actually by the end, you know, I called my exec over here, Tom Purcell, a Sunday night after I finished with the guys from Daft Punk. And I said, you know what? Actually, it ended up being a very positive, very positive conversation. And I really like where we got with it.
Yeah.
It makes a lot of sense to me, you know, from their point of view. They have their own artistic, you know, parameters.
Mm.
And I can respect that.
Mm.
And I said, and we can work within them. It'll work for us. I think it'll be fun. I think the audience will be satisfied. Then we can do our, you know, we can do our video. And by the way, at one point I thought I was going to cancel the video because I thought, well, I got Robin Thicke. Why do I want to do all that work?
Right.
And they said, well, Henry Kissinger said yes.
Oh, my God, which blew me away. That was the one that blew me away.
Henry Kissinger is going to let me come in and, like, pop and lock? And they said yes, and I said, okay, well then we're doing the video, even if, like, I don't know how we're gonna use it within the, because I knew the context with Daft Punk was changing. I didn't know.
I'm leaning into the feeling, is that because you first come into the door, you can't quite see us at the desk, it's a slow reveal. I'm like, that's fucking Henry Kissinger.
Yeah. So then Monday comes around, and we're, you know, those guys are coming, and we're working on the Monday show. As I said to, you know, the guys, I said, I'm glad we got this done on a Sunday, because on Monday I got the Monday show, and that's really got to be my day. And I was interviewing a congressman, and it was a super busy day. And then around 2 o'clock, my co-exec comes up, and she goes, we should talk.
Oh, geez.
And I said, what? And he goes, well, Daft Punk's also on the VMAs. And I went, no, okay, hold on. It worked out with Robin Thicke. I'm sure it's going to work out with Daft Punk. And so then I called again, the head of our network group, who he said, okay, I'm on it. Sure, I'll talk. You know, should be fine. And he may not have said should be fine. He goes, no, I'll talk. And I'm like, yeah, that's a reasonable sort of thing. And so then I find out nothing until... And the Daft Punk guys don't know whether to come. Like, should we come? Because they were about to hang out on the plane.
So we're like 2 days away from shooting this.
One day. It's 2 o'clock the day before. I said, I don't know. Should we come? I'm like, it's going to work out. Guys, trust me. That's a sister network. This is not, don't worry about
it. Plus, I'm a man of faith. I believe in mankind.
I had said, you know, I'd actually had such a positive, you know, thing with the Daft Punk guy. Says, I want you to know, like, you're not the only musical guest that night. Wouldn't want them to get here and see Robin perform, going, oh, we got, you know,
sandbagged.
Sandbagged here. Yeah. I said, I want you to know, you know, if this context is so important to you, that I want you to know the full context. And I said, I'm not going to tell you who the other person is. Mm-hmm. I said, because that's my relationship with them, and what if you don't do my show? Then you're not really...
It's a fine line between informing and asking permission.
Right, exactly. And I said, but I will let you know, and if you can't come for that reason, I would understand. And they said, no, that's fine with us. You know, we understand how that satisfies the rest of your narrative.
Right.
Okay. So again, positive. Everything's very positive with everybody.
We're clear to land.
Yep. And I'm feeling like, God damn it, we got a good, fun show here, and they've never done late night. This is going to be fun, you know. And then at 1:30 that in the night, I get an email, from my people. Over in our part of MTV network, saying, "Yeah, have you heard anything? Because we haven't heard anything." And I said, "No." And I said, "You know, the Daft Punk people are here. They came." And then the next day, I found out. I guess around 11:30 in the morning, saying, "Yeah, it doesn't look like it's going to happen. Unless it's going to happen, they're not going." They say, "You know," and this is what we end up saying on the show, is that I don't really know what the deal is. You know, it's always on some level a little mystery to me, is that MTV says they had an exclusive arrangement. Daft Punk people said they never had an exclusive arrangement.
So you don't know who's telling
both telling the truth, because I think I think there's some sort of a reasonable implication from MTV that, well, they don't do TV, and we had them. How are we to know that the only time they're doing TV, they're also doing another thing at the same time?
Right.
Even though it's 3 weeks out.
So for people who are listening to this who have not seen, go online and see the show. I'm sure pretty much everybody has at this point. But basically, Steven now has to do a show that has been publicized as having a major guest. And then you had to scurry from 2 o'clock the afternoon the day before until 4 or 5 o'clock that afternoon, day of the taping, and essentially rewrite a significant part of the show.
Oh, we didn't rewrite anything on Monday because I was confident it was going to work out. It never occurred.
So it was day of.
It was day of.
Unbelievable.
We didn't really know till 1 o'clock day of.
Unbelievable.
And we were confident it was going to work out. We're absolutely confident it would work out.
Now, at this point...
Let me finish. We were confident it would work out,
right?
Because, you know, I think, you know, as I said to somebody, I don't think that my joyful success diminishes anyone else's joyful success.
Right.
Like, you know, especially something 3 weeks from now in the VMAs. I'm like, I can't imagine.
Right.
How does it possibly harm them in any way?
Well, you said that one of the lines of the show is like, because once people hear a song, they would say,
once somebody sees a band they like, they never want to see them again.
Which is why,
that after the Beatles went on Ed Sullivan, they dropped off the face of the earth. So I really couldn't understand. Yes. I really was like kind of gobsmacked because I think, you know, you can't have anything good, I have to have all the good,
yeah,
is like the original sin of show business.
Yeah, exactly.
You know?
Yeah.
And I understand it's there,
yeah,
but I don't play it. Like, I never would,
well, at
I
least
never
not
ever
within
say,
the family of networks. That's the
to
thing.
No, no, it doesn't. That doesn't matter. To anyone. Like, I told our people here, I said,
I think it does. I could see a rival network playing this game with you, but within the family,
I could see that, but I wouldn't understand it. Like, I wouldn't understand it. Like, I've told our people here, I said, I never want you to, like, do the, if you're on them, you can't be on us, or whatever. I said, that makes no sense.
No, but what I'm saying is, it's more egregious, in my mind, that it's a sister network within the family versus a competing network.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. That's, to me,
that's
my own
thing. I don't know. It's just, like, as it was explained to me, that's a big part of it. It's traditional.
Yeah,
for
but
the
you're
VM.
A decent human being. That's my point about it.
But it's you know, it's traditional within the month leading up to the VMAs or whatever, you don't do other shows.
Yeah, okay.
Which is why an exception made for Robin Thicke for
me.
Okay. And I guess that was, I guess Daft Punk was one toke over the line because the specialness that they don't ever do TV,
right,
and that's robbed by going on for me.
Right.
You know, I can understand the logic of what you're saying internally.
Yeah.
I don't understand the idea that if you do that person's show, you can't do my show. I've right. never understood that.
I agree.
Have to do that person's show before you, like, you can't, I never understood. Yeah, you have to do us first.
Yes,
that makes no sense.
And they do the same thing.
That all says to me that you have no value that you add to the guest.
Right.
Do you know what
right,
I mean?
Right.
The guest's presence is the entire value. That means you are adding nothing to the formula.
Right,
that's
exactly
why I'm like, we can have this person, but they have to do X, Y, or Z first. I'm like, that's fine.
Yeah.
That's fine.
Yeah.
I won't do what they do.
Right.
I'll do something different.
Yeah,
exactly. So that's why that was so particularly mystifying to me,
yeah,
that I would be denied this thing, especially day of is when I find out,
right,
you know, I've sold the show. Everybody knows, like, people know, like, there was no mystery, like, we didn't keep it a secret with people within the business, within the network group of what we were trying to do.
No, but there's an issue. I did the warm-up of the show that day, and I didn't have to be told, but, like, don't tell them that they're not here. Like, you got to reveal to these people.
Oh, to the audience, sure, yeah, that's different. That's different. The relationship with the audience is different.
Yeah.
Okay. So anyway, so then we did the show that we did. You know, and I would say that I understand, like, VMA's got their own rules, and
yeah,
Daft Punk has, you know, that's a big, important thing to have done. But as I said to people on both sides, like, but I'm the guy who's completely screwed here.
Well,
I don't have a show tonight. Here, I want to say one thing, is that people who, I don't know Mr. Toffler, and people know him in common. Like, I have friends who know him,
right,
and they say he's just a great guy, and I believe them.
Yeah.
I believe
and
them.
This isn't about
we're just making jokes.
No, I understand.
Jokes about the predicament I was in.
Right, and I want to be clear that I'm not bringing him up specifically just to shit on him. You did that plenty good, but my point is this: I'm fascinated by process, especially having worked on the Daily Show for all these years. And so, at this stage of the game, it's 2-3 o'clock in the afternoon, and you're taking this guy to task in the script, who's a pretty powerful guy in the Viacom family. Do you call? And I'm not asking for names, but do you call somebody at Comedy Central and go, "Hey, just so you know, this is going to happen. I'm saying this stuff."
They read scripts anyway. No one asked me to change any jokes.
Wow, that's a real testament to Comedy Central.
No, it's great. No one, and I don't think they should, you know, the only time they ever ask me to change jokes is if, like, please don't say McDonald's gives you cancer. but here's the thing is, if there was a news story that says McDonald's gives you cancer,
different,
they would say, go ahead and
yeah,
do it. I mean, it's really, they afford us a lot of freedom over here. It's really that I have no complaints about that.
So have you...
And I have no complaints about, you know, their attempts to get me what I needed for my show yesterday. They were really great. Everybody at Comedy Central was like there was a full court press, you know, from the executives to everyone like in a pyramid of people were communicating with their other halves over at MTV.
So there was some negotiation going on.
I don't remember negotiation, but they were trying to explain what situation this put me in. And they just said we just couldn't do it, which is, you know, they're right. And I can understand within, you know, what their expectations are,
right,
of that show, and that's a big show for them every year. I just don't understand the baseline premise,
right,
of the denial. I don't understand the idea of exclusivity.
Yeah.
I don't understand that.
Was there any fallout from it in the last, any ramifications, any wrist slaps, any call from Van Toffler, any conversation,
no,
anything at all?
No, that's not the nature of
I mean, Comedy Central.
I'm surprised at that a little bit. I would have thought
none whatsoever.
Wow.
No, they're no. Matter of fact, all I've gotten from Comedy Central was that was great. not about you know Van because they like him, but and I've heard that there are wonderful reasons to. That he's actually a good and honest guy, you know, like that yeah. Among TV people that yeah. like he's like yeah, he's known to be a straight shooter, which is great. But and my opinion of him, of course, does not matter in any way, shape, or form. I'm just saying that's what I've
if the
heard.
Show were in his first year, would you have had the confidence to go after somebody like that?
Again, the idea that I'm going.
Oh, I'm sorry.
After
oh, to
him.
Explain, I used the wrong way. All right, okay. Let me.
I want to be clear.
No, you didn't. That's
what
my
I
bad.
Did. I believe what I did is, and I said everybody's got to have both their ethical and their fact hats on.
And you did.
And I said I want everything to be accurate.
Yes.
I said all I want to do is accurately explain what happened, and then embody my character's emotional reaction to it. Because if you want, I'm also in character when I'm doing this.
Yes.
As much as this mattered to me as a producer, my character can't ever lose. That's what I think we've missed out of this conversation, is that my character can't ever lose.
Right.
I respect, you know, V8, what are they called? MTV. VHS. I respect
Betamax.
MTV's, you know, rules that yeah. they set for themselves yeah. and their guests and their expectations. I respect Daft Punk making the decision they made.
Yeah.
But there's an emotional state from the guy who's completely fucked, a guy who never wants to ever lose.
Yeah, that's a good
and so
point.
He has to throw a tantrum.
Yeah. Yeah. That's exactly right.
Yeah.
Then that
I found the whole thing joyful. Like, I actually, it was exhausting to have to do in a day, but I remember we all said, yippee, look at what we get to do.
Is this again something
this
different?
This gives us an emotional state. We always want to approach the show from an emotional
right.
state. And it was really exciting and such a gift. It was really around 1 o'clock when it was possible that we might still get them.
Mm.
I was like, oh, I don't know what to do now if they come on because I'm so excited about the possibility of doing
thing.
This because I have this really pure emotional state
yeah.
to be.
No, and it's true. You weren't going after. You were just accurately reflecting. So the character that you developed at The Daily Show as a correspondent, which I know one time we were talking, you kind of initially based it on Stone Phillips.
Yeah, it was kind of more Stone Phillips.
But then as time went on, the Colbert that we know today kind of evolved as sort of the most strident.
Over there we started, well, news evolved.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, it was, I started off with much more, there was sort of a, when you say Stone Phillips, you mean like, you project intelligence, you project confidence,
right.
you know. Certainly there's a well-groomed
yeah.
aspect to it.
Yeah.
But really after 9/11, and it took us a while to realize it, or me as a performer of something to emulate, that after 9/11 the model really began to change into a far more strident. It was really after that that the rise of the nighttime pundit became much more important.
Right, right.
And so we, you know, I think they came to me. It was still originally in like 2002. Like, you've got to start. Can you think of a way to start doing more of a nighttime shout fest kind of character?
Right.
So we thought about that for a while.
Well, I remember there was the book, you know, and the line was, you had your own book coming out. It was a takeoff on
don't
a ride.
Don't buy this book if you don't have any balls.
Right, exactly.
And the tagline was, well, do you? Do you have any balls?
That was so
I
great.
Do. And then I show the audience my balls. But that's where that started.
Right.
And I like to say, this show is the first show that ever started as a promo for itself. Because we had a
right.
promo called The Colbert Report.
Right.
And then when John and I said, we want to do something else together, I said, I think I have to do a little more than this. I've really enjoyed working for you.
Right.
But I still want to work with you.
Right.
What could we do?
Right.
And we thought, why don't I just do the show that's in that fake promo we do at the
right.
Daily Show called The Colbert Report? And we went to Doug Herzog, and he said, that sounds great. I mean, and really, John and I had one meeting. It was about 45 minutes long. I typed up the notes for it.
Unbelievable.
And the show is that meeting.
Chuck Noblet, which was, you know, the character in Strangers with Candy, obviously.
Right.
I feel like, did that inform this sort of character you're doing now in some way, sort of the high status idiot, if you will?
Well, Chuck Noblet's related to this character in one way, in that Chuck Noblet, my character presently is unaware of his ignorances and his prejudices.
Mm-hmm.
Chuck Noblet is very aware
mm-hmm.
of it, and he lives in constant fear that someone will know how weak Chuck Noblet is, or how little Chuck Noblet knows.
Mm.
Chuck Knoblauch is aware of the tenuous nature of his position among his colleagues and his students and his family, that he will be seen as a fraud. Chuck Knoblauch is a fraud. My character is a fool.
Right.
The character on this show is a fool. That's a difference. Yeah.
And
Chuck Knoblauch is a more contemptible character. My character is an innocent.
And do you feel just...
My character is more related to Jerry Blank in some ways, because Jerry Blank was an innocent. She learned nothing from life.
That's a good point. Yeah. And it feels, too, that this character for you as Colbert today started, the focus seemed to be more about your character and your persona. And while it's still there, it seems the focus shifted to more addressing the world of politics and the media's coverage of politics. Has that evolved in your mind and changed in terms of the focus of the character, what you're doing and Colbert on the show?
The biggest change that has happened for the character came on very early, when we realized that the character could actually make news and could inject himself into a news story, and then we could report on, like we say, we throw the show like a pebble into the puddle of the news and report on our own ripples.
Yeah.
Games that we would play out in the real world, which actually would be informative of the news story itself. That got me more interested in news itself rather than playing the character. I still play the character, but I dial him up and down as need be.
Right.
It's not, you know, it's still the same guy. The show kind of came out of pre-assembled out of the box on night one.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly I play him looser.
Yeah.
He's looser. He's more fun than he used to be.
Yeah.
He has a lot more fun.
Yeah, and if
you know, every time, like, I just danced with the Rockettes. And after I danced with the Rockettes, I turned to my staff, which I sometimes say, and go, remember, guys, it's just like O'Reilly. We just do a parody of O'Reilly. I'm sorry.
Awesome, man. This is great. Thank you so much.
Thanks very much.
Yeah, this was great. I hope we had a good time.
Nice seeing you. Thanks for everything you do for me.
Absolutely, man.